This week and next, we will ponder the wisdom of Jesus regarding the relationship between wealth and spirit. Next week, we'll listen as Jesus meets a rich ruler and talks to him about camels and the eyes of needles. Today, though, in the passage Barbara just read for us, we'll hear Jesus tell a simple parable about a highly successful, well-to-do farmer who faces a storage quandary about all the crops he has produced. So he said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So it is with those who store up for themselves treasures, but are not rich toward God." It's an engaging story Jesus tells. Clearly one of the most compelling of the parables, the story of the rich fool. The parable is rooted in a simple request someone brings to Jesus, as you may remember, a request for help with a family dispute about an inheritance. But that request becomes a platform on which Jesus lays out a warning about the dangers of greed and a reminder that no one's life is based on an abundance of possessions. "Let me tell you a story," Jesus says. And the story he tells is of a rich landowner whose land produces an abundant harvest, and of the calculations this landowner performs leading to his conclusion that even his ample grain elevator is not big enough for all these crops. And so he resolves to tear it down and to build a bigger one, so that he'll be set for life. The problem, says Jesus, is that the man has left God out of the equation. So God speaks to this rich man and calls him a fool, because God knows that the man's life is going to come to an end that very evening. "All these things you have prepared," God inquires, "whose will they then be?" And then Jesus says, "Such is the case with any person who builds a personal treasure but is not rich toward God." It's a haunting story and an unsettling conclusion, even in these post-enlightenment, post-modern days. Two things in particular are striking to me about this story. The first is the way that God addresses the landowner. God doesn't call him a reprobate, doesn't call him a sinner. God calls him a fool. "You fool," God says, "you fool." Now, what is it exactly that makes of this man a fool? To many, his actions may seem prudent, forward-thinking, progressive. Why would he be considered a fool? It's a question that has long intrigued me. Several years ago, I spent an afternoon with a group of friends and colleagues who were wrestling with that very question as part of another colleague's Doctor of Ministry project. And so it was still in the back of my mind a few weeks later when we were on a family trip across Northwest England. And quite unexpectedly on that trip, I came across what I think might be a hint of an answer. We were in the car traveling from the village where we were staying north of Manchester to the Yorkshire town of Haworth, a town made famous, you may well remember, by the Bronte sisters who lived and wrote there with their pastor father in the mid-19th century. The trip involved crossing the moors, a vast expanse of rolling grassland and sedges that even in summer seemed to warn of an imposing wintry weather to come. The road across the moors that day was not very good by our standards, about 1.5 lanes of semi-paved thoroughfare, bordered on one side by the hillside above and on the other by even more hillside below. We are making our way across the moors and approaching a sweeping left turn when I saw the road sign. The sign had an arrow noting the turn that we were approaching, and underneath the arrow were the words, "Adverse Camber." We were, I suppose, 100 meters down the road, just coming out of that curve when the sign finally registered, and I asked, "What did that sign say?" And my cousin Alex, who was with us, was quick to respond, "Oh, it's my favorite road sign here," he said. And he explained that what you likely already know, that camber is tilt or slope or an arching. An adverse camber on that sign described a road that arched or tilted the wrong way. In our particular case, the sign spoke of a left turn in which the road, instead of banking to the left, actually sloped away to the right. I love road signs in the UK. And I had to laugh at the understatement of danger in that sign. Adverse camber indeed. I wondered how many people had driven off the road and down the hillside pondering what it meant. But as the day and the trip wore on, I began to think of that sign as a metaphorical explanation of why Jesus describes the rich landowner as a fool. It's because his life sloped the wrong way. Instead of cambering toward God in gratitude and toward neighbors in graciousness, it had begun to tilt precariously toward his own greedy assumptions. Instead of banking toward its source, his life had become imbalanced, and the centrifugal forces of avarice and self-indulgence were ready to run him off the road. A fool indeed. Some of you, I suspect, have heard or read Michael Lindball's helpful observation about the hidden danger in the various things that we acquire in the course of our lives. Whenever we buy something new, he says, when we open the box, we're customarily greeted not only by the thing itself, but by pages of written materials, owner's manuals, assembly diagrams, directions for use, warranty cards, surveys, and the like. All these pages, Michael says, can be classified in one of two categories, either as instructions or as warnings. Instructions on assembly, use, maintenance, registration, and warnings not to let kids put pieces in their mouths or not to use the product in the bathtub or without safety goggles. But Michael says maybe they should put one more instruction page in every box. It could say, "You are a fortunate consumer to have the ability to own this fine product. Remember to share what you have." And maybe they should put another warning label on every new product. In bold red letters on a white decal affixed to the side, it could read, "Warning, this thing, like all things, could be dangerous to your spiritual health." In Great Britain, of course, the decal could be less specific. It could simply say, "Peril of adverse camber." I'd argue today that it is his failure to recognize just such a peril that makes the rich fool a fool. He doesn't even realize that his life is tilted the wrong way. "So it is," Jesus said, "with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich toward God." That statement, of course, raises the other significant interpretive question, the other striking feature about this passage this morning. What does it mean to be rich toward God? Later in this very same chapter of Luke, Jesus will point to the linkage between the location of one's treasure and the location of one's heart. And in another story recorded in each of the three synoptic gospels, Jesus will speak of laying up treasures in heaven Is that what he means by being rich toward God? Biblical scholar Luke Timothy Johnson notes that rich toward God is a literal translation of the Greek, and suggests that for Luke, the phrase holds two levels of meaning. The first has to do with the faith we claim, and the second points toward the disposition of our possessions in accordance with that faith, or more precisely, our willingness to share them with others rather than accumulating them for ourselves. Moreover, I think of rich toward God as an attitude toward life, framed by gratitude to its source. I think of it as a life cambered toward its true center. Athey Keith is a Kentucky farmer in Wendell Berry's wonderful novel, Jaber Crow. He was the kind of farmer who eschewed the modernization and machine-driven agriculture of the corporate farm in favor of a kind of farming that took note of the needs of the land and tried to live in harmony with it. Athey Keith owned a lot of property near Port William, but Wendell Berry describes him this way. Athey was not exactly, or not only, what is called a landowner. He was the farm's farmer, but he was also its creature and its belonging. He lived its life, and it lived his, and he knew that of the two lives, his was meant to be the smaller and the shorter. In my life, I've known a whole generation of people like that, not necessarily farmers, though farmers seem to understand the contingencies of life better than others. But I've known many people who came of age in the 1930s, say, whose lifelong values were built around concepts not so much of bigger and faster and more productive, but of balance and proportion and scale. He was the farm's farmer, but he was also its creature and its belonging. He lived its life, and it lived his. Now, if the truth were told, I'm the product of a different generation. I grew up believing that old motto of General Electric, that progress is our most important product. I'm also a creature of comfort and a beneficiary of convenience, a child of technology and innovation. I'm disciplined about my resources to some degree, but I still tend to confuse wants and needs from time to time. Like others of my generation, I'm also a person who prefers control to contingency, or at least the illusion of control. While there are many people who see life through the lens of abundance, that is, who see a world full of gifts and of gracious sufficiency, there are others who always encounter the world by way of an anxiety about scarcity, who worry often that there won't be enough, and so feel the need to grasp and to hoard and to build bigger and bigger barns. In her book, The Soul of Money, Lynn Twiss speaks of sufficiency. She says, by sufficiency, I don't mean a quantity of anything. Sufficiency isn't two steps up from poverty or one step short of abundance. It isn't a measure of barely enough or of more than enough. Sufficiency isn't an amount at all. Sufficiency resides inside each of us, and we can call it forward. It is a consciousness, an attention, an intentional choosing of the way we think about our circumstances. Something like that sense, I believe, must have been behind Athey Keith's understanding of his life and vocation and land. Wendell Berry didn't use the word specifically, but behind the metaphors he employed to depict Keith was a profound sense of the stewardship of the earth, of the stewardship of life itself. A deep-rooted sense of stewardship simply affords one a different way of understanding this world. By stewardship, one sees life not in terms of control, but in terms of service and sacrifice for something much larger than our own selves. That was something, by the way, that people admired so much in John McCain, who we lost last night. A steward sees the world not in terms of limitless bounty, but in terms of thoughtful limits and appropriate boundaries. A steward lives and breathes a sense of sufficiency about life. Stewards know that the earth is ours, not in the sense that it belongs to us, so much as because by the expenditure of our energy and our work, we belong to it. A few weeks ago, I shared with you the words of Grove McCord, a Clyde Edgerton character, who said, "You are history longer than you are fact." Stewards understand that truth. They get that life is fleeting and that the faithful way of responding to that fact is not so much to acquire all we can acquire, building bigger and bigger barns, or even to see the earth and its riches as our rightful inheritance, but to know at our depths that we borrow the earth and its riches from our children and from generations yet unborn. Stewardship teaches us to number our days so that we may gain a heart of wisdom. It's more than romanticism that has allowed Wendell Berry's description of A.T. Keith to move me so across the years. I know myself well enough to know that I can be the romantic, the idealist from time to time. But there's a sculpted realism about me too that has come from watching so many people die over the years. Good people, gracious people, dear friends whom I have loved. I've watched so many of them come to terms with the fact that all their striving and all their acquisitiveness, even all their best efforts, ultimately had to be handed over to someone else and relinquished. Ultimately, and sooner for some than for others, their whole lives had to be handed back to God. In the end, many of them came to understand that the only thing that would finally matter after they were gone were the good that they had made possible along the way and the investment of time and energy in those they loved and those they served. I've noticed, too, that those who seem to find the greatest contentment in the face of life's final mystery were those who had lived their lives fully as stewards of the gifts that had been entrusted to them. Now, those who farm the land seem to understand such contentment better than many of us, I think. But not always. I've thought a lot about the two landowners I've had in my mind this morning. These two farmers, A.T. Keith and the one in Jesus' parable. And I've wondered about the difference between them. A.T. Keith may not have been a rich man in worldly terms. He may not have been a particularly intellectual man either, but he was no fool. Indeed, in the language of Luke's gospel, one might well have considered him rich toward God. He understood the nature of God's abundance. He understood his dependency on that abundance, understood that it was an abundance not of his own making, understood the way he belonged to that abundance far more than it ever belonged to him. The problem with the rich fool was that he couldn't see that at all. He just didn't get it, not one bit. As he rounded what would be the last sweeping turn of his life, he had no thought of God, no thought of gratitude, and all that he valued was soon to slip from his grasp because his life was so adversely cambered. And yet he thought he was at the top of his game. He never even noticed the danger until it was too late. Of course, that's what made him a fool.